Rule 4. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. The internal critic. It was easier for people to be good at something when more of us lived in small, rural communities. Someone could be homecoming queen. Someone else could be spelling bee champ, math whiz, or basketball star. There were only one or two mechanics and a couple of teachers. In each of their domains, these local heroes had the opportunity to enjoy the serotonin-fueled confidence of the victor. It may be for that reason that people who were born in small towns are statistically overrepresented among the eminent. If you're one in a million now, but originated in modern New York, there's 20 of you, and most of us now live in cities. What's more, we've become digitally connected to the entire 7 billion. Our hierarchies of accomplishment are now dizzyingly vertical. No matter how good you are at something, or how you rank your accomplishments, there is someone out there who makes you look incompetent. You're a decent guitar player, but you're not Jimmy Page or Jack White. You're almost certainly not even going to rock your local pub. You're a good cook, but there are many great chefs. Your mother's recipe for fish heads and rice, no matter how celebrated in her village of origin, doesn't cut it in these days of grapefruit foam and Scotch tobacco ice cream. Some mafia don has a tackier yacht. Some obsessive CEO has a more complicated self-winding watch, kept in his more valuable mechanical hardwood and steel automatic self-winding watch case. Even the most stunning Hollywood actress eventually transforms into the evil queen on eternal paranoid watch for the new Snow White. And you? Your career is boring and pointless. Your housekeeping skills are second rate. Your taste is appalling. You're fatter than your friends. And everyone dreads your parties. Who cares if you are Prime Minister of Canada when someone else is the President of the United States? Inside us dwells a critical internal voice and spirit that knows all this. It's predisposed to make its noisy case. It condemns our mediocre efforts. It can be very difficult to quell. Worse, critics of its sort are necessary. There's no shortage of tasteless artists, tuneless musicians, poisonous cooks, bureaucratically personality-disordered middle managers, hack novelists, and tedious ideology-ridden professors. Things and people differ importantly in their qualities. Awful music torments listeners everywhere. Poorly designed buildings crumble in earthquakes. Substandard automobiles kill their drivers when they crash. Failure is the price we pay for standards. And because mediocrity has consequences both real and harsh, standards are necessary. We are not equal in ability or outcome, and never will be. A very small number of people produce very much of everything. The winners don't take all, but they take most, and the bottom is not a good place to be. People are unhappy at the bottom. They get sick there and remain unknown and unloved. They waste their lives there. They die there. In consequence, the self-denigrating voice in the minds of people weaves a devastating tale. Life is a zero-sum game. Worthlessness is the default condition. What but willful blindness could possibly shelter people from such withering criticism? It is for such reasons that a whole generation of social psychologists recommended positive illusions as the only reliable route to mental health. Their credo? Let a lie be your umbrella. A more dismal, wretched, pessimistic philosophy can hardly be imagined. Things are so terrible that only delusion can save you. Here's an alternative approach, and one that requires no illusions. If the cards are always stacked against you, perhaps the game you are playing is somehow rigged, perhaps by you, unbeknownst to yourself. If the internal voice makes you doubt the value of your endeavors, or your life, or life itself, perhaps you should stop listening. If the critical voice within says the same denigrating things about everyone, no matter how successful, how reliable can it be? Maybe its comments are chatter, not wisdom. There will always be people better than you. That's a cliche of nihilism. Like the phrase, in a million years, who's going to know the difference? The proper response to that statement is not, well then, everything is meaningless. It's, any idiot can choose a frame of time within which nothing matters. Talking yourself into irrelevance is not a profound critique of being. It's a cheap trick of the rational mind. Many good games. Standards of better or worse are not illusory or unnecessary. If you hadn't decided that what you were doing right now was better than the alternatives, you wouldn't be doing it. The idea of a value-free choice is a contradiction in terms. Value judgments are a precondition for action. Furthermore, every activity, once chosen, comes with its own internal standards of accomplishment. If something can be done at all, it can be done better or worse. To do anything at all is therefore to play a game with a defined and valued end, which can always be reached more or less efficiently and elegantly. Every game comes with its chance of success or failure. Differentials in quality are omnipresent. Furthermore, if there was no better and worse, nothing would be worth doing. There would be no value, and, therefore, no meaning. Why make an effort if it doesn't improve anything? Meaning itself requires the difference between better and worse. How, then, can the voice of critical self-consciousness be stilled? Where are the flaws in the apparently impeccable logic of its message? We might start by considering the all too black and white words themselves, success or failure. You are either a success, a comprehensive, singular, overall good thing, or its opposite, a failure, a comprehensive, singular, irredeemably bad thing. The words imply no alternative and no middle ground. However, in a world as complex as ours, such generalizations, really such failure to differentiate, are a sign of naive, unsophisticated, or even malevolent analysis. There are vital degrees and gradations of value obliterated by this binary system, and the consequences are not good. To begin with, there's not just one game at which to succeed or fail. There are many games, and more specifically, many good games. Games that match your talents, involve you productively with other people, and sustain and even improve themselves across time. Lawyer is a good game. So is plumber, physician, carpenter, or school teacher. The world allows for many ways of being. If you don't succeed at one, you can try another. You can pick something better matched to your unique mix of strengths, weaknesses, and situation. Furthermore, if changing games does not work, you can invent a new one. I recently watched a talent show featuring a mime who taped his mouth shut and did something ridiculous with oven mitts. That was unexpected. That was original. It seemed to be working for him. It's also unlikely that you're playing only one game. You have a career and friends and family members and personal projects and artistic endeavors and athletic pursuits. You might consider judging your success across all the games you play. Imagine that you're very good at some, middling at others, and terrible at the remainder. Perhaps that's how it should be. You might object, I should be winning at everything. But winning at everything might only mean that you're not doing anything new or difficult. You might be winning, but you're not growing. And growing might be the most important form of winning. Should victory in the present always take precedence over trajectory across time? Finally, you might come to realize that the specifics of the many games you are playing are so unique to you, so individual, that comparison to others is simply inappropriate. Perhaps you are overvaluing what you don't have and undervaluing what you do. There's some real utility in gratitude. It's also good protection against the dangers of victimhood and resentment. Your colleague outperforms you at work. His wife, however, is having an affair, while your marriage is stable and happy. Who has it better? The celebrity you admire is a chronic drunk driver and bigot. Is his life truly preferable to yours? When the internal critic puts you down using such comparisons, here's how it operates. First, it selects a single arbitrary domain of comparison, fame, maybe, or power. Then it acts as if that domain is the only one that is relevant. Then it contrasts you unfavorably with someone truly stellar within that domain. It can take that final step even further, using the unbridgeable gap between you and its target of comparison as evidence for the fundamental injustice of life. That way, your motivation to do anything at all can be most effectively undermined. Those who accept such an approach to self-evaluation certainly can't be accused of making things too easy for themselves, but it's just as big a problem to make things too difficult. When we are very young, we are neither individual nor informed. We have not had the time nor gained the wisdom to develop our own standards. In consequence, we must compare ourselves to others because standards are necessary. Without them, there's nowhere to go and nothing to do. As we mature, we become, by contrast, increasingly individual and unique. The conditions of our lives become more and more personal and less comparable with those of others. Symbolically speaking, this means we must leave the house ruled by our father and confront the chaos of our individual being. We must take note of our disarray without completely abandoning that father in the process. We must then rediscover the values of our culture, veiled from us by our ignorance, hidden in the dusty treasure trove of the past, rescue them, and integrate them into our own lives. This is what gives existence its full and necessary meaning. Who are you? You think you know, but maybe you don't. You are, for example, neither your own master nor your own slave. You cannot easily tell yourself what to do and compel your own obedience, any more than you can easily tell your husband, wife, son, or daughter what to do and compel theirs. You are interested in some things and not in others. You can shape that interest, but there are limits. Some activities will always engage you and others simply will not. You have a nature. You can play the tyrant to it, but you will certainly rebel. How hard can you force yourself to work and sustain your desire to work? How much can you sacrifice to your partner before generosity turns to resentment? What is it that you actually love? What is it that you genuinely want? Before you can articulate your own standards of value, you must see yourself as a stranger, and then you must get to know yourself. What do you find valuable or pleasurable? How much leisure, enjoyment, and reward do you require so that you feel like more than a beast of burden? How must you treat yourself so you won't kick over the traces and smash up your corral? You could force yourself through your daily grind and kick your dog in frustration when you come home. You could watch the precious days tick by. Or you could learn how to entice yourself into sustainable, productive activity. Do you ask yourself what you want? Do you negotiate fairly with yourself? Or are you a tyrant with yourself as slave? When do you dislike your parents, your spouse, or your children, and why? What might be done about that? What do you need and want from your friends and your business partners? This is not a mere matter of what you should want. I'm not talking about what other people require from you or your duties to them. I'm talking about determining the nature of your moral obligation to yourself. Should might enter into it, because you're nested within a network of social obligations. Should is your responsibility, and you should live up to it. But this does not mean you must take the role of lapdog, obedient and harmless. That's how a dictator wants his slaves. Dare instead to be dangerous. Dare to be truthful. Dare to articulate yourself and express, or at least become aware of, what would really justify your life. If you allowed your dark and unspoken desires for your partner, for example, to manifest themselves, if you were even willing to consider them, you might discover that they were not so dark given the light of day. You might discover instead that you were just afraid, and so pretending to be moral. You might find that getting what you actually desire would stop you from being tempted and straying. Are you so sure that your partner would be unhappy if more of you rose to the surface? The femme fatale and the anti-hero are sexually attractive for a reason. How do you need to be spoken to? What do you need to take from people? What are you putting up with or pretending to like from duty or obligation? Consult your resentment. It's a revelatory emotion for all its pathology. It's part of an evil triad: arrogance, deceit, and resentment. Nothing causes more harm than this underworld trinity. But resentment always means one of two things. Either the resentful person is immature, in which case he or she should shut up, quit whining, and get on with it, or there is tyranny afoot, in which case the person subjugated has a moral obligation to speak up. Why? Because the consequence of remaining silent is worse. Of course, it's easier in the moment to stay silent and avoid conflict, but in the long term, that's deadly. When you have something to say, silence is a lie, and tyranny feeds on lies. When should you push back against oppression, despite the danger? When you start nursing secret fantasies of revenge. When your life is being poisoned, and your imagination fills with the wish to devour and destroy. I had a client decades ago who suffered from severe obsessive-compulsive disorder. He had to line up his pajamas just right before he could go to sleep at night. Then he had to fluff his pillow. Then he had to adjust the bed sheets over and over and over and over. I said, maybe that part of you, that insanely persistent part, wants something, inarticulate though it may be. Let it have its say. What could it be? He said, control. I said, close your eyes and let it tell you what it wants. Don't let fear stop you. You don't have to act it out just because you're thinking it. He said, it wants me to take my stepfather by the collar, put him up against the door, and shake him like a rat. Maybe it was time to shake someone like a rat, although I suggested something a bit less primal. But God only knows what battles must be fought forthrightly, voluntarily, on the road to peace. What do you do to avoid conflict, necessary though it may be? What are you inclined to lie about, assuming that the truth might be intolerable? What do you fake? The infant is dependent on his parents for almost everything he needs. The child, the successful child, can leave his parents, at least temporarily, and make friends. He gives up a little of himself to do that, but gains much in return. The successful adolescent must take that process to its logical conclusion. He has to leave his parents and become like everyone else. He has to integrate with the group so he can transcend his childhood dependency. Once integrated, the successful adult then must learn how to be just the right amount different from everyone else. Be cautious when you're comparing yourself to others. You're a singular being once you're an adult. You have your own particular, specific problems, financial, intimate, psychological, and otherwise. Those are embedded in the unique, broader context of your existence. Your career or job works for you in a personal manner, or it does not, and it does so in a unique interplay with the other specifics of your life. You must decide how much of your time to spend on this and how much on that. You must decide what to let go and what to pursue. The point of our eyes, or take stock. Our eyes are always pointing at things we are interested in approaching, or investigating, or looking for, or having. We must see, but to see, we must aim. So we are always aiming. Our minds are built on the hunting and gathering platforms of our bodies. To hunt is to specify a target, track it, and throw at it. To gather is to specify and to grasp. We fling stones and spears and boomerangs. We toss balls through hoops and hit pucks into nets and curl carved granite rocks down the ice onto horizontal bullseyes. We launch projectiles at targets with bows, guns, rifles, and rockets. We hurl insults, launch plans, and pitch ideas. We succeed when we score a goal or hit a target. We fail or sin when we do not, as the word sin means to miss the mark. We cannot navigate without something to aim at, and while we are in this world, we must always navigate. We are always and simultaneously at point A, which is less desirable than it could be, moving towards point B, which we deem better in accordance with our explicit and implicit values. We always encounter the world in a state of insufficiency and seek its correction. We can imagine new ways that things could be set right and improved, even if we have everything we thought we needed. Even when satisfied, temporarily, we remain curious. We live within a framework that defines the present as eternally lacking and the future as eternally better. If we did not see things this way, we would not act at all. We wouldn't even be able to see, because to see we must focus, and to focus we must pick one thing above all else on which to focus. But we can see. We can even see things that aren't there. We can envision new ways that things could be better. We can construct new, hypothetical worlds where problems we weren't even aware of can now show themselves and be addressed. The advantages of this are obvious. We can change the world so that the intolerable state of the present can be rectified in the future. The disadvantage to all this foresight and creativity is chronic unease and discomfort. Because we always contrast what is with what could be, we have to aim at what could be. But we can aim too high, or too low, or too chaotically. So we fail, and live in disappointment, even when we appear to others to be living well. How can we benefit from our imaginativeness, our ability to improve the future, without continually denigrating our current, insufficiently successful and worthless lives? The first step, perhaps, is to take stock. Who are you? When you buy a house and prepare to live in it, you hire an inspector to list all its faults. As it is, in reality, now. Not as you wish it could be. You'll even pay him for the bad news. You need to know. You need to discover the home's hidden flaws. You need to know whether they are cosmetic imperfections or structural inadequacies. You need to know, because you can't fix something if you don't know it's broken. And you're broken. You need an inspector. The internal critic, it could play that role if you could get it on track, if you and it could cooperate. It could help you take stock. But you must walk through your psychological house with it and listen judiciously to what it says. Maybe you're a handyman's dream, a real fixer-upper. How can you start your renovations without being demoralized, even crushed by your internal critic's lengthy and painful report of your inadequacies? Here's a hint. The future is like the past. But there's a crucial difference. The past is fixed, but the future, it could be better. It could be better, some precise amount. The amount that can be achieved, perhaps in a day, with some minimal engagement. The present is eternally flawed. But where you start might not be as important as the direction you are heading. Perhaps happiness is always to be found in the journey uphill, and not in the fleeting sense of satisfaction awaiting at the next peak. Much of happiness is hope, no matter how deep the underworld in which that hope was conceived. Called upon properly, the internal critic will suggest something to set in order, which you could set in order, which you would set in order, voluntarily, without resentment, even with pleasure. Ask yourself, is there one thing that exists in disarray in your life or your situation that you could and would set straight? Could you and would you fix that one thing that announces itself humbly in need of repair? Could you do it now? Imagine that you are someone with whom you must negotiate. Imagine further that you're lazy, touchy, resentful, and hard to get along with. With that attitude, it's not going to be easy to get you moving. You might have to use a little charm and playfulness. Excuse me, you might say to yourself, without irony or sarcasm, I'm trying to reduce some of the unnecessary suffering around here. I could use some help. Keep the derision at bay. I'm wondering if there's anything that you would be willing to do. I'd be very grateful for your service. Ask honestly and with humility. That's no simple matter. You might have to negotiate further, depending on your state of mind. Maybe you don't trust yourself. You think that you'll ask yourself for one thing, and having delivered, immediately demand more. And you'll be punitive and hurtful about it, and you'll denigrate what was already offered. Who wants to work for a tyrant like that? Not you. That's why you don't do what you want yourself to do. You're a bad employee, but a worse boss. Maybe you need to say to yourself, okay, I know we haven't gotten along very well in the past. Sorry about that. I'm trying to improve. I'll probably make some more mistakes along the way, but I'll try to listen if you object. I'll try to learn. I noticed just now today that you weren't really jumping at the opportunity to help when I asked. Is there something I could offer in return for your cooperation? Maybe if you did the dishes, we could go for coffee. You like espresso? How about an espresso? Maybe a double shot? Or is there something else you want? Then you could listen. Maybe you'll hear a voice inside. Maybe it's even the voice of a long-lost child. Maybe it will reply, "Really? You really want to do something nice for me? You really do it? It's not a trick?" This is where you must be careful. That little voice, that's the voice of someone once burnt and twice shy. So you could say very carefully, "Really, I might not do it very well, and I might not be great company, but I will do something nice for you. I promise." A little careful kindness goes a long way, and judicious reward is a powerful motivator. Then you could take that small bit of yourself by the hand and do the damn dishes. And then you better not go clean the bathroom and forget about the coffee or the movie or the beer, or it will be even harder to call those forgotten parts of yourself forth from the nooks and crannies of the underworld. You might ask yourself, what could I say to someone else? My friend, my brother, my boss, my assistant, that would set things a bit more right between us tomorrow? What bit of chaos might I eradicate at home, on my desk, in my kitchen, tonight, so that the stage could be set for a better play? What snakes might I banish from my closet and my mind? 500 small decisions, 500 tiny actions compose your day, today and every day. Could you aim one or two of those at a better result? Better in your own private opinion, by your own individual standards. Could you compare your specific personal tomorrow with your specific personal yesterday? Could you use your own judgment and ask yourself what that better tomorrow might be? Aim small. You don't want to shoulder too much to begin with, given your limited talents, tendency to deceive, burden of resentment, and ability to shirk responsibility. Thus, you set the following goal. By the end of the day, I want things in my life to be a tiny bit better than they were this morning. Then you ask yourself, what could I do that I would do that would accomplish that? And what small thing would I like as a reward? Then you do what you have decided to do, even if you do it badly. Then you give yourself that damn coffee in triumph. Maybe you feel a bit stupid about it, but you do it anyway. And you do the same thing tomorrow, and the next day, and the next. And with each day, your baseline of comparison gets a little higher. And that's magic. That's compound interest. Do that for 3 years, and your life will be entirely different. Now you're aiming for something higher. Now you're wishing on a star. Now the beam is disappearing from your eye, and you're learning to see. And what you aim at determines what you see. That's worth repeating. What you aim at determines what you see. What you want and what you see. The dependency of sight on aim, and therefore on value, because you aim at what you value, was demonstrated unforgettably by the cognitive psychologist Daniel Simons more than 15 years ago. Simons was investigating something called sustained inattentional blindness. He would sit his research subjects in front of a video monitor and show them, for example, a field of wheat. Then he would transform the photo slowly, secretly, while they watched. He would slowly fade in a road cutting through the wheat. He didn't insert some little easy-to-miss footpath either. It was a major trail, occupying a good third of the image. Remarkably, the observers would frequently fail to take notice. The demonstration that made Dr. Simons famous was of the same kind, but more dramatic, even unbelievable. First, he produced a video of two teams of three people. One team was wearing white shirts, the other black. The two teams were not off in the distance either, or in any way difficult to see. The six of them filled much of the video screen, and their facial features were close enough to see clearly. Each team had its own ball, which they bounced or threw to their other team members, as they moved and fainted in the small space in front of the elevators where the game was filmed. Once Dan had his video, he showed it to his study participants. He asked each of them to count the number of times the white shirts threw the ball back and forth to one another. After a few minutes, his subjects were asked to report the number of passes. Most answered 15. That was the correct answer. Most felt pretty good about that. Ha! They passed the test. But then Dr. Simons asked, "Did you see the gorilla?" "Was this a joke? What gorilla?" So he said, "Watch the video again. But this time, don't count." Sure enough, a minute or so in, a man dressed in a gorilla suit waltzes right into the middle of the game for a few long seconds, stops, and then beats his chest in the manner of stereotyped gorillas everywhere, right in the middle of the screen. Large as life, painfully and irrefutably evident. But one out of every two of his research subjects missed it the first time they saw the video. It gets worse. Dr. Simons did another study. This time he showed his subjects a video of someone being served at a counter. The server dips behind the counter to retrieve something and pops back up. So what? Most of his participants don't detect anything amiss. But it was a different person who stood up in the original server's place. No way, you think. I'd notice. But it's yes way. There's a high probability you wouldn't detect the change, even if the gender or race of the person is switched at the same time. You're blind, too. This is partly because vision is expensive, psychophysiologically expensive, neurologically expensive. Very little of your retina is high-resolution fovea, the very central, high-resolution part of the eye, used to do such things as identify faces. Each of the scarce foveal cells needs 10,000 cells in the visual cortex merely to manage the first part of the multi-stage process of seeing. Then each of those 10,000 requires 10,000 more just to get to stage 2. If all your retina was fovea, you would require the skull of a B-movie alien to house your brain. In consequence, we triage when we see. Most of our vision is peripheral and low resolution. We save the fovea for things of importance. We point our high-resolution capacities at the few specific things we are aiming at, and we let everything else, which is almost everything, fade unnoticed into the background. If something you're not attending to pops its ugly head up in a manner that directly interferes with your narrowly focused current activity, you will see it. Otherwise, it's just not there. The ball on which Simon's research subjects were focused was never obscured by the gorilla or by any of the six players. Because of that, because the gorilla did not interfere with the ongoing narrowly defined task, it was indistinguishable from everything else the participants didn't see when they were looking at the ball. The big ape could be safely ignored. That's how you deal with the overwhelming complexity of the world. You ignore it, while you concentrate minutely on your private concerns. You see things that facilitate your movement forward toward your desired goals. You detect obstacles when they pop up in your path. You're blind to everything else, and there's a lot of everything else, so you're very blind. And it has to be that way, because there is much more of the world than there is of you. You must shepherd your limited resources carefully. Seeing is very difficult, so you must choose what to see and let the rest go. There's a profound idea in the ancient Vedic texts, the oldest scriptures of Hinduism and part of the bedrock of Indian culture. The world as perceived is Maya, appearance or illusion. This means in part that people are blinded by their desires, as well as merely incapable of seeing things as they truly are. This is true in a sense that transcends the metaphorical. Your eyes are tools. They are there to help you get what you want. The price you pay for that utility, that specific focused direction, is blindness to everything else. This doesn't matter so much when things are going well and we are getting what we want, although it can be a problem even then because getting what we currently want can make us blind to higher callings. But all that ignored world presents a truly terrible problem when we're in crisis and nothing whatsoever is turning out the way we want it to. Then there can be far too much to deal with. Happily, however, that problem contains within it the seeds of its own solution. Since you've ignored so much, there is plenty of possibility left where you have not yet looked. Imagine that you're unhappy. You're not getting what you need. Perversely, this may be because of what you want. You are blind because of what you desire. Perhaps what you really need is right in front of your eyes, but you cannot see it because of what you are currently aiming for. And that brings us to something else. The price that must be paid before you or anyone can get what they want, or better yet, what they need. Think about it this way. You look at the world in your particular idiosyncratic manner. You use a set of tools to screen most things out and let some things in. You've spent a lot of time building those tools. They've become habitual. They're not mere abstract thoughts. They're built right into you. They orient you in the world. They're your deepest and often implicit and unconscious values. They've become part of your biological structure. They're alive. And they don't want to disappear or transform or die. But sometimes their time has come and new things need to be born. For this reason, although not only for this reason, it is necessary to let things go during the journey uphill. If things are not going well for you, well, that might be because, as the most cynical of aphorisms has it, life sucks and then you die. Before your crisis impels you to that hideous conclusion, however, you might consider the following. Life doesn't have the problem. You do. At least that realization leaves you with some options. If your life is not going well, perhaps it is your current knowledge that is insufficient, not life itself. Perhaps your value structure needs some serious retooling. Perhaps what you want is blinding you to what else could be. Perhaps you are holding on to your desires in the present so tightly that you cannot see anything else, even what you truly need. Imagine that you're thinking enviously, I should have my boss's job. If your boss sticks to his post stubbornly and competently, thoughts like that will lead you into a state of irritation, unhappiness, and disgust. You might realize this. You think, I am unhappy. However, I could be cured of this unhappiness if I could just fulfill my ambition. But then you might think further. Wait, you think. Maybe I'm not unhappy because I don't have my boss's job. Maybe I'm unhappy because I can't stop wanting that job. That doesn't mean you can just simply and magically tell yourself to stop wanting that job and then listen and transform. You won't, can't, in fact, just change yourself that easily. You have to dig deeper. You must change what you are after more profoundly. So you might think, I don't know what to do about this stupid suffering. I can't just abandon my ambitions. That would leave me nowhere to go. But my longing for a job that I can't have isn't working. You might decide to take a different tack. You might ask instead for the revelation of a different plan, one that would fulfill your desires and gratify your ambitions in a real sense, but that would remove from your life the bitterness and resentment with which you are currently affected. You might think, I will make a different plan. I will try to want whatever it is that would make my life better, whatever that might be, and I will start working on it now. If that turns out to mean something other than chasing my boss's job, I will accept that, and I will move forward. Now you're on a whole different kind of trajectory. Before, what was right, desirable, and worthy of pursuit was something narrow and concrete. But you became stuck there, tightly jammed and unhappy. So you let go. You make the necessary sacrifice and allow a whole new world of possibility, hidden from you because of your previous ambition, to reveal itself. And there's a lot there. What would your life look like if it were better? What would life itself look like? What does better even mean? You don't know. And it doesn't matter that you don't know exactly right away, because you will start to slowly see what is better once you have truly decided to want it. You will start to perceive what remained hidden from you by your presuppositions and preconceptions, by the previous mechanisms of your vision. You'll begin to learn. This will only work, however, if you genuinely want your life to improve. You can't fool your implicit perceptual structures. Not even a bit. They aim where you point them. To retool, to take stock, to aim somewhere better, you have to think it through, bottom to top. You have to scour your psyche. You have to clean the damn thing up. And you must be cautious, because making your life better means adopting a lot of responsibility, and that takes more effort and care than living stupidly in pain and remaining arrogant, deceitful, and resentful. What if it was the case that the world revealed whatever goodness it contains in precise proportion to your desire for the best? What if the more your conception of the best has been elevated, expanded, and rendered sophisticated, the more possibility and benefit you could perceive? This doesn't mean that you can have what you want merely by wishing it, or that everything is interpretation, or that there is no reality. The world is still there with its structures and limits. As you move along with it, it cooperates or objects. But you can dance with it, if your aim is to dance. And maybe you can even lead if you have enough skill and enough grace. This is not theology. It's not mysticism. It's empirical knowledge. There's nothing magical here, or nothing more than the already present magic of consciousness. We only see what we aim at. The rest of the world, and that's most of it, is hidden. If we start aiming at something different, something like, I want my life to be better, our minds will start presenting us with new information derived from the previously hidden world to aid us in that pursuit. Then we can put that information to use and move and act and observe and improve. And after doing so, after improving, we might pursue something different or higher, something like, I want whatever might be better than just my life being better. And then we enter a more elevated and more complete reality. In that place, what might we focus on? What might we see? Think about it like this. Start from the observation that we indeed desire things, even that we need them. That's human nature. We share the experience of hunger, loneliness, thirst, sexual desire, aggression, fear, and pain. Such things are elements of being, primordial, axiomatic elements of being. But we must sort and organize these primordial desires, because the world is a complex and obstinately real place. We can't just get the one particular thing we especially just want now, along with everything else we usually want, because our desires can produce conflict with our other desires, as well as with other people and with the world. Thus, we must become conscious of our desires and articulate them and prioritize them and arrange them into hierarchies. That makes them sophisticated. That makes them work with each other and with the desires of other people and with the world. It is in that manner that our desires elevate themselves. It is in that manner that they organize themselves into values and become moral. Our values, our morality, they are indicators of our sophistication. The philosophical study of morality, of right and wrong, is ethics. Such study can render us more sophisticated in our choices. Even older and deeper than ethics, however, is religion. Religion concerns itself not with mere right and wrong, but with good and evil themselves, with the archetypes of right and wrong. Religion concerns itself with domain of value, ultimate value. That is not the scientific domain. It's not the territory of empirical description. The people who wrote and edited the Bible, for example, weren't scientists. They couldn't have been scientists even if they had wanted to be. The viewpoints, methods, and practices of science hadn't been formulated when the Bible was written. Religion is instead about proper behavior. It's about what Plato called the good. A genuine religious acolyte isn't trying to formulate accurate ideas about the objective nature of the world, although he may be trying to do that too. He's striving, instead, to be a good person. It may be the case that to him, good means nothing but obedient, even blindly obedient. Hence, the classic liberal Western Enlightenment objection to religious belief. Obedience is not enough. But it's at least a start. and we have forgotten this. You cannot aim yourself at anything if you're completely undisciplined and untutored. You will not know what to target, and you won't fly straight even if you somehow get your aim right. And then you will conclude, there is nothing to aim for, and then you will be lost. It is therefore necessary and desirable for religions to have a dogmatic element. What good is a value system that does not provide a stable structure? What good is a value system that does not point the way to a higher order? And what good can you possibly be if you cannot or do not internalize that structure or accept that order? Not as a final destination necessarily, but at least as a starting point. Without that, you're nothing but an adult 2-year-old without the charm or the potential. That is not to say, to say it again, that obedience is sufficient. But a person capable of obedience, let's say instead a properly disciplined person, is at least a well-forged tool. At least that. And that is not nothing. Of course, there must be vision beyond discipline, beyond dogma. A tool still needs a purpose. It is for such reasons that Christ said in the Gospel of Thomas, "The kingdom of the Father is spread out upon the earth, but men do not see it." Does that mean that what we see is dependent on our religious beliefs? Yes! And what we don't see as well. You might object, "But I'm an atheist." No, you're not. And if you want to understand this, you could read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, perhaps the greatest novel ever written, in which the main character Raskolnikov decides to take his atheism with true seriousness, commits what he has rationalized as a benevolent murder, and pays the price. You're simply not an atheist in your actions, and it is your actions that most accurately reflect your deepest beliefs, those that are implicit, embedded in your being, underneath your conscious apprehensions and articulable attitudes and surface-level self-knowledge. You can only find out what you actually believe, rather than what you think you believe, by watching how you act. You simply don't know what you believe before that. You are too complex to understand yourself. It takes careful observation, and education, and reflection, and communication with others, just to scratch the surface of your beliefs. Everything you value is a product of unimaginably lengthy developmental processes, personal, cultural, and biological. You don't understand how what you want, and therefore what you see, is conditioned by the immense, abysmal, profound past. You simply don't understand how every neural circuit through which you peer at the world has been shaped, and painfully, by the ethical aims of millions of years of human ancestors and all of the life that was lived for the billions of years before that. You don't understand anything. You didn't even know that you were blind. Some of our knowledge of our beliefs has been documented. We've been watching ourselves act, reflecting on that watching, and telling stories distilled through that reflection for tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands of years. That is all part of our attempts, individual and collective, to discover and articulate what it is that we believe. Part of the knowledge so generated is what is encapsulated in the fundamental teachings of our cultures, in ancient writings such as the Tao Te Ching, or the aforementioned Vedic scriptures, or the biblical stories. The Bible is, for better or worse, the foundational document of Western civilization, of Western values, Western morality, and Western conceptions of good and evil. It's the product of processes that remain fundamentally beyond our comprehension. The Bible is a library composed of many books, each written and edited by many people. It's a truly emergent document, a selected, sequenced, and finally coherent story written by no one and everyone over many thousands of years. The Bible has been thrown up out of the deep by the collective human imagination, which is itself a product of unimaginable forces operating over unfathomable spans of time. Its careful, respectful study can reveal things to us about what we believe and how we do and should act that can be discovered in almost no other manner. Old Testament God and New Testament God. The God of the Old Testament can appear harsh, judgmental, unpredictable, and dangerous, particularly on cursory reading. The degree to which this is true has arguably been exaggerated by Christian commentators, intent on magnifying the distinction between the older and newer divisions of the Bible. There has been a price paid, however, for such plotting, and I mean that in both senses of the word. The tendency for modern people to think, when confronted with Jehovah, "I would never believe in a God like that." But Old Testament God doesn't much care what modern people think. He often didn't care what Old Testament people thought either, although he could be bargained with to a surprising degree, as is particularly evident in the Abrahamic stories. Nonetheless, when his people strayed from the path, when they disobeyed his injunctions, violated his covenants, and broke his commandments, trouble was certain to follow. If you did not do what Old Testament God demanded, whatever that might have been, and however you might have tried to hide from it, you and your children and your children's children were in terrible, serious trouble. It was realists who created, or noticed, Old Testament God. When the denizens of those ancient societies wandered carelessly down the wrong path, they ended up enslaved and miserable, sometimes for centuries, when they were not obliterated completely. Was that reasonable? Was that just? Was that fair? The authors of the Old Testament asked such questions with extreme caution and under very limited conditions. They assumed instead that the creator of being knew what he was doing, that all power was essentially with him, and that his dictates should be carefully followed. They were wise. He was a force of nature. Is a hungry lion reasonable, fair, or just? What kind of nonsensical question is that? The Old Testament Israelites and their forebears knew that God was not to be trifled with, and that whatever hell the angry deity might allow to be engendered if he was crossed was real. Having recently passed through a century defined by the bottomless horrors of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, we might realize the same thing. New Testament God is often presented as a different character, although the book of Revelation, with its final judgment, warns against any excessively naive complacency. He is more the kindly Geppetto, master craftsman and benevolent father. He wants nothing for us but the best. He is all-loving and all-forgiving. Sure, he'll send you to hell if you misbehave badly enough. Fundamentally, however, he's the God of love. That seems more optimistic, more naively welcoming, but, in precise proportion to that, less believable. In a world such as this, this hothouse of doom, who could buy such a story? The all-good God in a post-Auschwitz world? It was for such reasons that the philosopher Nietzsche, perhaps the most astute critic ever to confront Christianity, considered New Testament God the worst literary crime in Western history. In Beyond Good and Evil, he wrote, "In the Jewish Old Testament, the book of divine justice, there are men, things, and speeches on such a grand style that Greek and Indian literature has nothing to compare with it. One stands with fear and reverence before those stupendous remains of what man was formerly, and one has sad thoughts about old Asia and its little outpushed peninsula Europe. To have bound up this New Testament, a kind of rococo of taste in every respect, along with the Old Testament into one book, as the Bible, as the book in itself, is perhaps the greatest audacity and sin against the spirit which literary Europe has on its conscience." Who but the most naive among us could posit that such an all-good, merciful being ruled this so terrible world? But something that seems incomprehensible to someone unseeing might be perfectly evident to someone who had opened his eyes. Let's return to the situation where your aim is being determined by something petty, your aforementioned envy of your boss. Because of that envy, the world you inhabit reveals itself as a place of bitterness, disappointment, and spite. Imagine that you come to notice, and contemplate, and reconsider your unhappiness. Further, you determine to accept responsibility for it, and dare to posit that it might be something at least partly under your control. You crack open one eye for a moment, and look. You ask for something better. You sacrifice your pettiness, repent of your envy, and open your heart. Instead of cursing the darkness, you let in a little light, you decide to aim for a better life instead of a better office. But you don't stop there. You realize that it's a mistake to aim for a better life if it comes at the cost of worsening someone else's. So you get creative. You decide to play a more difficult game. You decide that you want a better life in a manner that will also make the life of your family better, or the life of your family and your friends, or the life of your family and your friends and the strangers who surround them. What about your enemies? Do you want to include them too? You bloody well don't know how to manage that. But you've read some history. You know how enmity compounds. So you start to wish even your enemies well, at least in principle, although you are by no means yet a master of such sentiments. And the direction of your sight changes. You see past the limitations that hemmed you in unknowingly. New possibilities for your life emerge, and you work toward their realization. Your life, indeed, improves. And then you start to think further. Better? Perhaps that means better for me, and my family, and my friends, even for my enemies. But that's not all it means. It means better today, in a manner that makes everything better tomorrow and next week and next year and a decade from now and 100 years from now and 1,000 years from now and forever. And then better means to aim at the improvement of being with a capital I and a capital B. Thinking all of this, realizing all of this, you take a risk. You decide that you will start treating Old Testament God, with all his terrible and oft arbitrary seeming power, as if he could also be New Testament God, even though you understand the many ways in which that is absurd. In other words, you decide to act as if existence might be justified by its goodness, if only you behaved properly. And it is that decision, that declaration of existential faith, that allows you to overcome nihilism and resentment and arrogance. It is that declaration of faith that keeps hatred of being with all its attendant evils at bay. And as for such faith, it is not at all the will to believe things that you know perfectly well to be false. Faith is not the childish belief in magic. That is ignorance or even willful blindness. It is instead the realization that the tragic irrationalities of life must be counterbalanced by an equally irrational commitment to the essential goodness of being. It is simultaneously the will to dare set your sights at the unachievable and to sacrifice everything, including, and most importantly, your life. You realize that you have literally nothing better to do. But how can you do all this, assuming you are foolish enough to try? You might start by not thinking. Or, more accurately but less trenchantly, by refusing to subjugate your faith to your current rationality and its narrowness of view. This doesn't mean make yourself stupid. It means the opposite. It means instead that you must quit maneuvering and calculating and conniving and scheming and enforcing and demanding and avoiding and ignoring and punishing. It means you must place your old strategies aside. It means instead that you must pay attention, as you may have never paid attention before. Pay attention. Pay attention. Focus on your surroundings, physical and psychological. Notice something that bothers you, that concerns you, that will not let you be, which you could fix, that you would fix. You can find such somethings by asking yourself, as if you genuinely want to know, 3 questions. What is it that is bothering me? Is that something I could fix? And would I actually be willing to fix it? If you find that the answer is no to any or all of the questions, then look elsewhere. Aim lower. Search until you find something that bothers you, that you could fix, that you would fix, and then fix it. That might be enough for the day. Maybe there is a stack of paper on your desk, and you have been avoiding it. You won't even really look at it when you walk into your room. There are terrible things lurking there, tax forms and bills and letters from people wanting things you aren't sure you can deliver. Notice your fear and have some sympathy for it. Maybe there are snakes in that pile of paper. Maybe you'll get bitten. Maybe there are even hydras lurking there. You'll cut off one head and seven more will grow. How could you possibly cope with that? You could ask yourself, is there anything at all that I might be willing to do about that pile of paper? Would I look, maybe, at one part of it for 20 minutes? Maybe the answer will be no. But you might look for 10, or even for 5, and if not that, for 1. Start there. You will soon find that the entire pile shrinks in significance merely because you have looked at part of it, and you'll find that the whole thing is made of parts. What if you allowed yourself a glass of wine with dinner, or curled up on the sofa and read, or watched a stupid movie as a reward? What if you instructed your wife or your husband to say, "Good job," after you fixed whatever you fixed? Would that motivate you? The people from whom thanks you want might not be very proficient in offering it to begin with, but that shouldn't stop you. People can learn, even if they're very unskilled at the beginning. Ask yourself what you would require to be motivated to undertake the job, honestly, and listen to the answer. Don't tell yourself, "I shouldn't need to do that to motivate myself." What do you know about yourself? You are, on the one hand, the most complex thing in the entire universe, and on the other, someone who can't even set the clock on your microwave. Don't overestimate your self-knowledge. Let the tasks for the day announce themselves for your contemplation. Maybe you can do this in the morning as you sit on the edge of your bed. Maybe you can try the night before when you are preparing to sleep. Ask yourself for a voluntary contribution. If you ask nicely and listen carefully and don't try any treachery, you might be offered one. Do this every day for a while. Then do it for the rest of your life. Soon you will find yourself in a different situation. Now you will be asking yourself habitually, "What could I do that I would do to make life a little better?" You are not dictating to yourself what better must be. You're not being a totalitarian or a utopian, even to yourself, because you have learned from the Nazis and the Soviets and the Maoists, and from your own experience, that being a totalitarian is a bad thing. Aim high. Set your sights on the betterment of being. Align yourself in your soul with truth and the highest good. There is habitable order to establish and beauty to bring into existence. There's evil to overcome, suffering to ameliorate, and yourself to better. It is this, in my reading, that is the culminating ethic of the canon of the West. It is this, furthermore, that is communicated by those eternally confusing, glowing stanzas from Christ's Sermon on the Mount, the essence, in some sense, of the wisdom of the New Testament. This is the attempt of the spirit of mankind to transform the understanding of ethics from the initial necessary "thou shalt not" of the child and the Ten Commandments into the fully articulated positive vision of the true individual. This is the expression, not merely of admirable self-control and self-mastery, but of the fundamental desire to set the world right. This is not the cessation of sin, but sin's opposite, good itself. The Sermon on the Mount outlines the true nature of man and the proper aim of mankind. Concentrate on the day so that you can live in the present and attend completely and properly to what is right in front of you. But do that only after you have decided to let what is within shine forth so that it can justify being and illuminate the world. Do that only after you have determined to sacrifice whatever it is that must be sacrificed so that you can pursue the highest good. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Therefore, take no thought, saying, "What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed?" For after all these things do the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Luke 12:22-34. Realization is dawning. Instead of playing the tyrant, therefore, you're paying attention. You're telling the truth instead of manipulating the world. You're negotiating instead of playing the martyr or the tyrant. You no longer have to be envious because you no longer know that someone else truly has it better. You no longer have to be frustrated because you've learned to aim low and to be patient. You're discovering who you are, and what you want, and what you are willing to do. You are finding that the solutions to your particular problems have to be tailored to you, personally and precisely. You are less concerned with the actions of other people because you have plenty to do yourself. Attend to the day, but aim at the highest good. Now, your trajectory is heavenward. That makes you hopeful. Even a man on a sinking ship can be happy when he clambers aboard a lifeboat. And who knows where he might go in the future. To journey happily may well be better than to arrive successfully. Ask, and ye shall receive. Knock, and the door will open. If you ask, as if you want, and knock, as if you want to enter, you may be offered the chance to improve your life, a little, a lot, completely. And with that improvement, some progress will be made in being itself. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today.